I was talking with someone earlier today about a student who came here to check us out, and I had 20 minutes or so to go over Zazen with her. And as I usually do, I'll ask some questions. For example, have you ever meditated before? What is your reason for coming here? What are you hoping to get out of it? And she proceeded to tell me about various other forms of meditation she had done and some very special experiences that she had. Some of them were quite, I might say, outlandish, but they were pretty amazing. And I got the sense that that's what she was looking for here. So I also felt, after teaching her how to do Zazen and talking about Zazen not being about that, that we do Zazen just to do Zazen, and that anything that might happen out of our Zazen, we best view as a byproduct. Now, some very important things come out of our Zazen practice, but when we aim for them, they tend not to happen because we're constantly checking. We're separating ourselves from the process, which is the exact opposite of what Zazen is. So just to remind everyone, the word Zazen, which is the core practice of Zen Buddhism, comes from the Japanese word for sit, which is za, and absorption, which is zen, which came from the Sanskrit dhyana, meaning absorption. So to absorb yourself is to become very intimate, so intimate with this thing we call Zazen, that you can't even begin to formulate an aim for it, a goal for it, something you're checking to see if it's happening. Because the moment you do that, you've pulled yourself out of Zazen. It's a classic paradox. Can't be done. Well, I tried to explain this in, you know, a very gentle way. And later I gave a teisho that night, and I talked about, some of you remember what I said. One of the things I said, and I think this is the first thing I said, was that there's nothing at all magical about Zen practice. There's nothing magical about it. You're not going to do it and expect, you know, rainbows, lollipops, manna from heaven, levitation, extraordinary, you know, mind wide open, glowing with neon lights, walking down the street as a realized Buddha type things. That's not what Zen practice is really about. But at the same time, and this is the next thing I said, there's nothing magical about it. It's not going to create some space that's otherworldly, but it's deeply mysterious. Why? Because the thinking mind, the planning mind, the mind that is doing things for a reason, for a purpose, checking, comparing, making maps, making templates, can't go there. It just can't go to that territory. So it is automatically mysterious. Well, that student never came back. I didn't think she would. I guess it wasn't exactly what she was hoping for or looking for, and that's totally understandable. That's without any judgment. Because if you think about it, from the time we are infants, we are continually accumulating knowledge. Every moment, first from our mother, then from our father, then from our brother and sister, from friends, from television, from school, from teachers, from books, from the playground, from the school of hard knocks, all along the way, accumulating, accumulating, accumulating. And we become extremely good at it. And this is the wonderful talent of the human mind, that it can create maps, take this knowledge and synthesize it and apply it to the world, what I call nailing handles on the world, so you can manipulate it to get what you want, to avoid what you don't want, to hold on to things that you're afraid might slip away. That's the human condition, that's natural. We all are prone to that behavior. But Zen is not that. It may be the only thing that isn't. How strange. I mean, we've entered an era now where you never not know anything. Think about it. You never not know anything. Have you ever been with a group of friends and someone makes a statement about some recent event or something in history or some scientific point, and someone else takes issue with it, and then there's an argument, and then all of a sudden someone pulls their smartphone out, and Mama Google, as I call her, very lovingly, has the answer. So you never not know anything anymore. What a strange world we live in. We never not know anything. We are so good at knowing, at having the world all figured out. But this is not that. How wonderful. Now, just to highlight this a little bit, there's a wonderful Zen koan that I have mentioned in other Taisho, and that for me is, I hold it very close to my heart. I don't know why, but it just very much resonates with me. And you've heard it before, but I'll tell it again. A traveling monk, and this was back, I suppose, in the Tang Dynasty, or maybe a little bit later, a traveling monk happened upon a monastery deep in the woods. He was doing a pilgrimage, and he heard that there was a great Zen master there. The Zen master's name was Hogen. And so he made it over to this little hermitage in the middle of the woods and sat down that evening with Hogen. They probably had some tea. And then Hogen asked him a question. He said, what is the reason for your pilgrimage? Now, let me just say something right now. If a Zen master ever asks you a question, right off the bat, you can bet she's not just making conversation. Now, this monk, you know, obviously we weren't there. The story, it's kind of bare bones, but I can see this monk with eyes wide open, maybe mouth half open, staring into Hogan's eyes for a long time, maybe a tear coming to his eye and starting to stream down his cheek. In the silence of the woods, maybe with just some crickets in the background. And after a long time, he said, I don't know. And Hogen said to him, not knowing is most intimate. And the monk started to cry, to weep. All this time, he was trying to understand why. What's the purpose? What's the reason? Why am I doing this? It's so hard. It's so difficult. I don't know why I'm doing this. I've tried to figure it out. I can't. I don't know why. Hogen, not knowing is most intimate. Now, when I was a teenager, this is before I encountered Zen, before I was so fortunate as to one day reach into a backpack and pull a book out that a friend had given me. But this was a few years before, and in French class, we all read a book. It was called L'Étranger by Albert Camus, which is, in English it means the stranger. And this book came from the philosophy of existentialism, which I then got very into as a teenager, because I had already abandoned Western religions. I thought they just held nothing for me, and they were full of magical thinking. And this spoke to some part of me really, really strongly. I remember after that I read a book called Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre, another Frenchman. It's interesting, this movement, a lot of it came from France, but probably also from Germany. There's a whole school of philosophy called phenomenology. Martin Heidegger and another philosopher, Husserl, were proponents of this. And anyway, in this book, Nausea, Jean-Paul Sartre went into deeply into the philosophy of existentialism. And I feel that this encounter somehow prepared the ground for my later deep interest in Zen when I first encountered it. But the one of the tenets of existentialism is that despite all our efforts to make sense out of the world and give it purpose, the world is fundamentally, in the word they use, absurd. Absurd. There is no reason. There is no meaning. How interesting. Now, so what's the difference? What's the difference between Hogan and Jean-Paul Sartre? Well, first of all, Jean-Paul Sartre, in this book where he was the protagonist and encountering an object and then suddenly seeing the absurdity, seeing through the shell of his ideas about the object to the absurd, purposeless being of the object, then reacted with a visceral sensation which he called nausea, and that was the title of the book. So there was something fundamentally negative and despairing about existentialism. And yet for me it was very refreshing because it was honest. It pulled the surface veneer off of things. It showed something raw underneath. No, it was not the solution to my search. It only made me more depressed. But what about Zen? And why is there a difference here? Well, first of all, when you come right down to it, philosophers philosophize. They think about. They make a model of. What does the Zen student do? The Zen student, step by step by step, unlearns, peels off the meanings, lets go of purpose, and goes profoundly with mind and body into the center of their experience. There's no room there for philosophy. Really, when you come right down to it, there's no room there even for words. Because when you get down to that level, where are the words? How could you put that into words? How would you explain that to someone who had never done it? What words would you use? You'd say, fold your legs, back taut, eyes half open, right hand on the bottom, left hand on top, lightly touch your thumbs. Close your mouth and breathe through your nose. Just one. Just two. One has no meaning. Two, no meaning. Three, no meaning. Oh, a thought arose. The thought, no meaning. It's just this moment after moment. One Zen master once said, from birth until death, it's only just this. How do we use this, though? I mean, it's one thing on the cushion. Okay, I'll plunge into this present moment. But what about my everyday life? What about when things come up and I get caught? And I get stuck? I'm afraid. I'm depressed about something. What then? How does this help me? You know, my day job, I call it my side job, is an ER doctor. One of the things that you encounter very frequently in the emergency room are things that you might call behavioral emergencies. That's what they call them. It's the euphemism for what I think would more honestly be called the human, the raw human condition. People come in and they're afraid. They're despairing. And often for very good reason. They have some terrible chronic disease, or they were just given a terrible diagnosis, or they just had a heart attack. But very often it's a young person who comes in and they're just in a panic. Panic attacks are very, very common. So what would you do with a panic attack? What would you do with it? Well, first of all, what is it? What is panic? Panic is fear, but it's more than just fear. It's fear of the fear. And then you fear the fear of the fear, and you fear the fear of the fear of the fear, and then you're in a vicious circle, and it just goes incredibly intense and crazy. And people suffer horribly. And in about 20 minutes, it's over, but you feel very shaken. And I've seen this many, many, many times. So what would I say to someone in that situation? When the fear arises, do your best not to fear it. Just see it. Fear is just fear. It has no meaning. Now you might say, and I know it's very, very difficult to do. For a Zen student, perhaps with all our training, that's what we're practicing here. When fear arises, wrap your arms around it. No resistance. No fear of it. No blocking it. I've called this radical acceptance. You radically come here, come in. You can come here too. You can have your moment in the sunshine of my awareness. And do you know what that's called? That's called Zazen. That's what Zazen is. Anything that arises is given gratefully its moment in the sunshine of your awareness, just as it is. No need to explain it. No need to hold on to it. No need to fight it because it doesn't mean anything. There's a wonderful koan that I wanted to read to you all that kind of addresses this in a very nice way. Now, like most koan, it is initially kind of hard to get your mind around it. That's the way these things are written. They're so beautiful. I hope you all get a chance to go deeply into the treasure of koans. It's so wonderful. Like poetry, it doesn't come right out and explain itself. It makes you go down under the words to find out what it really means. But let's look at this koan, keeping in mind what I said about people coming into the ER with panic attacks. And in your everyday life, things happen. You get a toothache. What do you do about that? You know, so obviously it means your tooth is rotten, you have to go to the dentist, but what are you going to do right now with that toothache? What are you going to do with it? So this koan is number 33 in a collection by Dogen. It's his 100th koan that he felt were very significant. And the title of this koan, let me make sure I'm not running over time, I got plenty of time. The title of this koan is Kaoshan's Falling and Rising. So I'll read it. It's pretty short. This is the main case. Kaoshan was once asked by a monastic, quote, "It has been said since ancient times that no one has fallen on the ground who has not risen up without using the ground." And then the monastic asked Kaoshan, "What is falling?" Isn't that interesting? So he's making this quote to the master, Kaoshan. It has been said since ancient times that no one has fallen on the ground who has not risen up without using the ground. He's trying to figure out, what did that mean? He's trying to figure, what does it mean, falling? What does it mean, falling? He's trying to figure it out. Kaoshan says to him, if you are in accord with this, falling is just as it is. Oh, you know right away, this person, very earnest, I'm sure, trying to figure this out is going to be left with his mouth hanging wide open. So he answers now, the monastic asks the next question. What is rising? And Kaoshan said, rising. Now, this koan is a little difficult. So, what does it mean that no one has fallen on the ground no one who has fallen on the ground has not risen without using the ground? Think about this now. How many times do we fall on the ground every day? How many times do circumstances trap us, block us, frustrate us? Think about it. And how do we deal with it? Very often, by opposing, strategizing, distracting ourselves, all the ways that, as a human being, it's very touching. We all probably are prone to this. We try to work around it, and we end up spending much of our day with a constant stream of strategic thinking to deal with one exigency after another. What is Kaoshan saying here? He says, if you're in accord with this, falling is just as it is. Let me remind you of a scene in a movie. I've mentioned this before as well. It's just so precious and wonderful, but it's a scene in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, where the person who committed suicide in order to escape his horrible life and all the difficulties and problems he had with money and horrible pressures and this awful person who's going to take over the town, finally is given his life back. And during the period of time before he killed himself, he was so frustrated. Everything was going wrong. Everything. It was like you broke your leg and then you went outside to go to the doctor and it started raining on you and you slipped and fell in a puddle. It was kind of like that, one thing after another after another. And one beautiful scene in this movie is coming down this banister, his hand coming down the banister, coming down the stairs, and he got to the bottom of this little wooden ball at the end of the banister, and it would always come off in his hand. And eventually, in the movie, before he killed himself, he was so frustrated, he took this thing and he slammed it down. Well, now he came back to his house after being given his life back, after what seemed to him an eternity. And he ran up the stairs and he gave his two girls big hugs and kisses. He was deliriously happy, tears streaming down his face. He came down the banister again, down the stairs, hand on the banister. At the bottom, the ball came off in his hand. And you see him with this ball looking at it. And you're thinking, he's going to slam that thing down. What does he do? He kisses it. Kisses it. So Kaoshan says here, if you are in accord with using the ground to stand up, using the thing that tripped you up, the thing that bruised you when you hit it, if you use it to stand up and you're in accord with the deep meaning of this, that we take our life as it comes, we embrace our life as it comes, All of these things that we think are hurting us, falling on them, blocking us, we wrap our arms around them. If I am in accord with this, Kaoshan said, falling is just as it is. It's just this. It has no meaning. It's my life, moment after moment after moment. And that, my friends, is called Zazen. Now this monk didn't quite get it. So he said, well, what is rising? He's still trying to figure it out. And Kaoshan just said, rising. Rising is rising. Falling is falling. A toothache is a toothache. One is one. Two is two. Three is three. We get very simple this way. This is the beauty of this practice. We are unlearning. We are stripping off, letting go, ununderstanding. As Hogan said, not knowing. Now, in this not knowing, what happens? We become so intimate with each moment of life because we no longer have a shell over it. We are no longer holding it off, strategizing about it. We have invited it in. We've given it its moment in the sunshine of our awareness, and we've wrapped our arms around it. That is how not knowing becomes most intimate. So this is the essence of our Zen practice. This is something that student who came here, I don't think, really got. For her, meditation was going to be a vehicle, a tool to some other place, some place very different than your ordinary realm, a place of extraordinary experiences, of, you know, glowing and emanating and all this stuff, which I call byproducts. It's very hard to get it that this practice is so very simple. It is sinking into the actual present moment. When you fall on the ground too, you embrace that. Falling is just falling. Rising is just rising. Toothache is just a toothache. This is the deep secret of this practice. We are all so fortunate that through all the byways of life, all the different paths that can be taken, all the things that we were taught from the time we were newborns, somehow, in spite of all that, our paths led us here at this very moment, sitting in a circle and really grokking this. How unusual, how rare. So we'll end there tonight.